Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. As we look back on the first full week of spring, it's appropriate that we also celebrate the return of the Northeast Organic Farming Association Connecticut Chapter's 41st Winter Conference that concluded with the first in-person event since 2020. And like we've been doing for decades, For the People was on scene to bring you interviews with CT NOFA leadership, reps from the FDA and the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, as well as vendors talking about seeds, alpacas, sustainable appliances, and environmentally safe products and practices. So stay tuned and join the award-winning For the People as we plant ourselves on the Wesleyan University campus to experience everything CT NOFA. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Homes for the Brave, in partnership with the University of Bridgeport's Fones School of Dental Hygiene, is offering its latest session of free oral screenings and oral care and health presentations at the Homes for the Brave Annex in downtown Bridgeport. It's happening April 11th from 1:15 to 4 p.m. at 1 Lafayette Circle at the Homes for the Brave Annex. This session is open to the public and no appointments are necessary, so members of the community are encouraged to take advantage of these services. For more information, just visit homesforthebrave.org.
Well, it wouldn't be an organic farming conference without representation by the USDA, United States Department of Agriculture, and we've got a homegrown representative from USDA. Nathan Wilson's with us. He's with the Farm Service Agency here at the NOFA conference at Wesleyan University. Nathan, great to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well.
So tell me a little bit about how the big kind of national quilt work of USDA, how the Connecticut puzzle piece fits in as far as you and your colleagues are concerned.
Well, we reach every county in the nation, every state. So we're here representing FSA for Connecticut, and we have programs for Connecticut farmers to support their endeavors, to market their products, to grow their businesses, and stay in business, hopefully.
Are you more trained in, like, political science, or are you more from a farm or agricultural background yourself?
Myself, I have an ag business degree and grew up on a farm in Nebraska, actually.
Oh, okay.
I have some ag background in my behind.
So what's an example of the way you interact with farmers or folks in ag businesses in Connecticut?
Well, we can provide loans. We have programs, subsidy programs, to help support in times of low prices. We have ad hoc disaster programs. If there's floods, for example, we can help provide assistance to recover from those disasters.
And there's been a sad amount of that over the past few years.
For sure. Everything from drought to flood and back to drought. So it's an ever-changing climate for sure.
Yeah. So what are a few of the cool trends in agriculture that you're seeing, folks who are coming to USDA for some, financial assistance or guidance? Connecticut is rich with a lot of niche type of agricultural industries. What are a few of the things that you're seeing here in Connecticut that are sort of, trending strong?
Well, for sure, the small fruit and vegetable growers, we're seeing some interesting crops in that regard, which is interesting. There's a lot of diversity in Connecticut for sure, and then we've seen some interest in bees lately, which is good to see. We need more bees and healthy bees. Those are probably some of the bigger ones, I guess, of trends.
Yeah. You guys are getting a lot of support from communities now, not just in Connecticut, but across the country, who are sort of the reserve troops on these pollinator pathway type of task forces. But do you find that a lot of farmers are adding beekeeping as a means of, proliferating their crops and basic survival?
Well, it's an important component for sure. I think at times they kind of hire it in. There's a set beekeeper that has the colonies, and then he rents his colonies out, if you will. Mm-hmm. There's definitely some trends in that regard.
Yeah. When people are coming to you folks looking for financial assistance, is it more for startups, or are a lot of farms in Connecticut actually fortifying, expanding, or upgrading brick and mortar or equipment or irrigation systems, or is it like kind of all of the above?
I would say all of the above. We're glad to see the young folks come in and try to start, and we do have good loan programs for that, beginning farmer loan programs. But also the long-standing operations that need assistance for the years when the markets are not so good, we're glad to be able to help them stay in business.
I see there's some literature here about micro farm programs. How small can you actually be and still enjoy the support and assistance of the USDA?
It kind of comes down to just having an operation where you're selling a product, and really there's not really a minimum size, if you will.
Okay.
It could be, especially in Connecticut, very small acreage, a backyard. Oh. But if you're generating things out of a greenhouse to sell, there's programs to help with that, for sure.
Well, where would people that might be listening to the program in Connecticut go to learn more? Is it just USDA.gov and then put in their location?
Yeah, there's a good website, actually. Farmers.gov it's an ideal website for people to get started with us. There's an office locator. They can find the nearest office and contact point. They can kind of check out our loan programs, see what loans might be a fit. They can even apply right on the website there, and then we'll process their applications from there.
Very good. Nathan Wilson is with the Farm Service Agency of the United States Department of Agriculture here at Wesleyan and the Northeast Organic Farming Association's big annual conference. Thank you, Nathan. Good to meet you.
Thank you. Nice to meet you as well.
Well, as we make our way around the vendors, we have found a new friend. Corey Fink is with us here, and he operates a company called Focus Seeds. And Corey, as I heard you telling a couple folks here, you're kind of unique to Connecticut. Why is that?
Yeah, I'm the only vegetable and herb seed producer within Connecticut, at least that I know of. So I produce, seeds that are heirloom open pollinated and, native to locally grown in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. So what's your background, and what made you kind of get into this whole thing?
Yeah, so I have a degree in horticulture, and then after that I went into vegetable farming. I ran a CSA farm for about 6 years, and then I started transitioning into, seed saving, and that more or less, created its own business.
So this is becoming a real thing, and there's been a lot going on in Connecticut with seed saving and seed trading too, right?
Yeah, I mean, seed trading is, there's always been kind of a farming and underground gardener community that's traded seeds, especially now too. I also worked in the hemp industry doing breeding, CBD varieties and stuff. And so, especially within the cannabis, scene, there's been a lot of seed trading and stuff like that. So it's nice to see people, starting to, trade more seeds, more plants in the area, and kind of incorporating all that into the garden.
Hmm. So are we at the point now, like we're going to be probably broadcasting this around the end of March, is it sort of already too late in the cycle of things to start thinking about seeds and getting the right ones to get a garden started to yield anything for our tables and kitchens this year?
Yeah, there's still a lot of things you can start growing this time of year. Now's in March is a perfect time to start, like peppers, and then it's going to be, eggplants, and then in April, it's going to be tomatoes, and that's all indoors. But even if people want to start in, you know, June or July, you can still direct sow cucumbers, squash, beans. So there's still a ton of options for people, even if they're getting a late start.
So what do folks that are just starting out or maybe a year or two into a more of a frustration than a bounty, what are a few things people need to know about the beginning of it all, the seeds?
As far as what do you mean?
Well,
like,
you know, what do people need to consider? Are there, like, it would be going to a company like you have advantages to just going to a garden shop or a big box store and buying their tomato seeds?
Yes, especially when it comes to, like, example, like big box stores that have, you know, seedlings or something. Those are usually grown either in the south or out west and then shipped in. The advantage with my seeds is that they're locally adapted, so they're used to our growing environment. So they're going to be, you know, resistant to pests and diseases that we deal with on a regular basis instead of, you know, seeds or plants that come from, you know, across the country.
For people that want to see the best end result, what are a couple tips that you can give folks that are listening about getting the seeds, getting the right seeds and getting them started right so that their end product is as best as it can be?
Yeah, one thing, like I said, is direct sowing. People who are new to gardening and get a little, you know, little nervous about starting something inside and how well it's going to do, you know, just start right outdoors in the garden, especially with something like beans or squash, where you can sow them, you know, a few times during the year. If, you know, plant some squash seeds, if they don't come up or, you know, the plants, you know, aren't looking good, you can always sow another round. And especially summer squash, you're going to get a harvest within, if you have a good early variety, look for stuff that's, you know, 60, 70 days to maturity. Same thing with beans, or even greens, you know, kale, you can sow that basically direct seed it all season long.
And getting a little bit more into the science of things, what is it that you do in terms of either practice or, you know, kind of keeping the gene pool right or what have you? What are the scientific aspects of creating the kind of seeds that Focus Seeds produces that make yours something that might be of preference to folks that want to get it right and do it good?
Yeah, so like I said before, because everything's locally adapted, it's going to grow better here, but a lot of work kind of goes into it before that. So I have to try a lot of different varieties, so I'm growing out, you know, plants and varieties of all different crop types, seeing which ones do best, and then saving the seeds from those. I have to make sure that I have adequate population sizes, so plants are, you know, robust and vigorous. You know, you can't grow too little of some varieties because they'll get what's called inbreeding depression. So it's about maintaining that genetic diversity of that crop and making sure it is suitable to grow here.
Great. How do people learn more about you?
You can visit my website. It's focusseeds.com. Focus is spelled P-H-O-C-A-S. You can also find me on Instagram at Focus Seeds.
Corey Fink here with us, teaching us about how it all gets started in the garden at the Northeast Organic Farming Association's conference here at Wesleyan. Corey, great to meet you. Good luck.
Yeah, you as well. Thanks.
It's so good to be live here at the Northeast Organic Farming Association's conference at Wesleyan University, and we're so pleased to be hanging out for just a few minutes with Christine Joyna. She's with the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. So as we were chatting before we turned on the microphone, it's really all about Christine. What's this all about?
Very nice to be here. Thanks for having me. So we are a nonprofit. We serve farmer, food producer, homesteader, cottage food making members across the country, and we help them get their products to market. So there's a lot of regulatory touch points that restrict them and make it more difficult sometimes to get their products to market. So we help them figure out what do the laws say, what requirements do they have to meet, whether it's in meat processing, poultry processing, egg sales, dairy products, what are they producing, where do they want to sell it, what are the legal requirements for producing that food. You know, we go all the way down, we look at the federal laws for each of these types of foods, and what do they say about being able to produce the food and selling it, what did the state laws say, and then what does even your local town a municipality have to say. So there might be certain zoning restrictions that you've got to think about as to whether you can put a farm stand or certain structures on your land. Can you sell your products from your land? Can you sell your products at the local farmers market? You know, what can you sell? Where can you sell? We help figure that all out for our members.
So you mentioned before we turned on the microphone that you're a paralegal. Can you give an example of a case or two that you have either seen or been involved with to kind of illustrate how a agricultural professional might need to come to the fund for some support?
Yeah, so I would say one area that we deal in most is raw milk. A lot of people want to be able to consume raw milk. They think it has a lot more healthful benefits than pasteurized milk. But most states say that it's illegal to sell raw milk. So where we can, states have different positions on what's called a herd share agreement. Where we can, we will prepare these for our members that will allow them to have their customers become part small part owners in the herd, and now it's no longer a sale of milk in the way that is prohibited under the law. It's a direct distribution to a part owner, but you have to establish that ownership relationship, and that is one way that we really can help our members get their products to the market. So again, where it's allowed, we look at the law and make sure that we're always complying well within the legal parameters of what the law allows, but that's a good solution for a lot of our members.
Yeah, it almost sounds like a farm share arrangement from raw milk.
Exactly. So again, it's people becoming part owners in the herd, and then it's not a sale to the public, which is generally not allowed. It's a direct distribution, direct to the customer who's become a part owner. So yeah.
I also found it all interesting how like farmers markets are sort of like little Vaticans for farmers, because there's a lot of things that municipalities may permit at a farmer's market where, like, if they just went down the street to the next parking lot and set up, it would be forbidden.
It's tricky because a lot of times what federal rules and state rules say you can do and where you can sell, then you get to the farmer's market and they have their own set of rules and regulations. And generally, you have to follow them. I mean, they're running an operation the way they want to run it, and they set up their rules. But we try to help them. You know, if we think that there's something maybe that the farmer's market is misinterpreting in local regulations, help work with them to, like, understand that there's a different interpretation and maybe see if we can resolve that. But sometimes it's very difficult. Farmers markets have the right to set their own rules, so it can be challenging.
How well do federal issues and state issues play well together in the sandbox in Connecticut?
Yeah, I mean, they do, you know, there's always a federal standard that's set, and then generally in each of these food categories we've been talking about, and then states can choose to adopt something that's more strict. I think Connecticut does pretty well in not going too strict above what the federal regulations set. So I think there is a fair amount of food freedom in Connecticut for farmers and food producers.
Yeah. So for the quintessential person who's had a successful career somewhere else, but they have property or maybe they're about to inherit some, and they say, you know, I'm going to spend the next half of my career life doing something in the agricultural industry, what are a couple of the most important things that individuals coming to the industry as newbies might need to know from a legal perspective to help them avoid the stumbling blocks that might normally occur to someone who's venturing into a brand new field?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of considerations that maybe we don't handle tax, finances, land ownership. That's a little outside of our mission, but when it comes to producing food, I would say just start really very local first. You really need to understand what your town allows, because if you look at all the federal rules and you get everything straight and then you try to set up something that your town doesn't allow, you've done all that work, you've set up your operations, maybe you've bought equipment, and now you're dealing with a real roadblock. So really figure out, what are you zoned for? Are you on agricultural land? Generally, there's a lot more leeway for what a farmer could do on agricultural land, but if you're in a different zoning district, it may be challenging. So you really have to figure out what is allowed, what are they going to let you do with your property, and then you can build your plans from there and just go up the chain to all those different levels.
And I guess with aquaculture and things like hydroponics, It's not about all about conventional farming out of the ground anymore either, right?
Yes, there's, and we're, I wouldn't say we're experts yet, but we're getting a lot more requests in those areas, and so we're trying to really help our members figure out what all those rules are as well, and it expands what we can offer guidance on.
So do you guys look for volunteers, for people like yourself or paralegals or lawyers to come to the cause to add their expertise when needed?
So we, like I said, we support members across the country, but we don't have lawyers on staff that are licensed to practice in every state. So definitely on the legal side, we look for lawyer partners in every state. That are willing to do pro bono or low bono discounted legal work for our members. And so we want someone who's licensed to practice in every state helping us out. So we're constantly looking for those partners. Anyone who's interested in that should definitely reach out.
So is there like a Connecticut chapter of the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund?
Or we don't really have
like affiliated?
Yeah, but we have, again, we have partners that we work with. And now NOFA has become a really good partner of ours in the Northeast. And so we're very happy to partner with them. Other like organizations, but then again, we try to find lawyers that will help us with our work for members in this state.
Well, we'll wrap things up with you, Christine, just letting folks know where to learn more about the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund.
Great. Thank you so much. Appreciate you talking to me today.
A website or anywhere folks can go to learn more?
Farmtoconsumer.org, and it will tell you everything you need to know, and you can look at our membership rates, and there's a lot of educational information as well on the site that people can access.
Christine Joyna, a paralegal, a presenter here today, and representing the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund at the NOFA Connecticut Garden Conference here at Wesleyan University for 2023. Thanks again, Christine.
Thank you.
Well, as we move through the vendors here at the Northeast Organic Farming Association Connecticut's conference, we meet Dan Bernsteel with Remo Greenhouse Systems. And Dan, I guess greenhouses aren't just for farms and farmers anymore. It's becoming a big thing for homeowners and sophisticated non-commercial gardeners, right?
Yeah, that's true. We just created our own smaller greenhouse called the Bobcat. We're selling it both ourselves off our website. We've also partnered with Johnny's Selected Seeds. We're selling it on their website as well. It's a 16-foot wide greenhouse starting at 48 foot long, but it's cost affordable so homeowners can grow in them as well.
So this really can give a person who wants to have sustainable, fresh food that they control year-round capacity, right?
Yeah, that's right. And it also is a kind of an entry point to that larger growing if someone's interested in that. The smaller price point allows people to experiment growing in a real high tunnel instead of trying to build something themselves that could blow away or fall down after a few months. This is going to be rock solid. It's going to be there. And then if someone decides, hey, I really like doing this, I want to step up to that next level, it's basically just a smaller version of that next level up.
What are a few of the things that consumers need to look out for when they're trying to sort of separate what may be a problematic or negative greenhouse experience from one that is more successful and sustainable?
That's a good question. You know, our company has been in business for about 20 years, so we've kind of gone through the rigmarole of the testing and trialing. It can be really tough to figure this stuff out. So especially trying to figure out on your own can be dangerous. Buying secondhand can be really dangerous as well. We've talked to a few growers. They say, you know, I did it myself. I bought secondhand. Then I bought a Rimmel. I'm not buying anything else again. I'm going with Rimmel again, you know. I think making sure that that quality is there, making sure that it can stand up to the elements is really important. And, you know, making sure it's using good materials. So we use all U.S. steel. It's all sourced from right here in Hooksett, New Hampshire, and then we supply it nationwide.
So are you basically just the shelter structure, or is Rimmel also into the interior systems and infrastructure as well?
We do most everything that will be in your greenhouse. Heating, ventilation, we can do lighting, light deprivation, environmental controls. pretty much everything.
Well, I appreciate you taking a few minutes to chat with us today, Dan. Dan Bernsteel is with Rimmel Greenhouse Systems. And is it just Rimmel.com?
What's the RimmelGreenhouses.com, or you can call our office at 603-629-9004. I'm there Monday through Friday.
Great to meet you, Dan. Thanks.
Hey, you too. Thank you.
Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Hey, have you heard the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, issued 932 safety recalls affecting more than 30 million vehicles last year, the second highest number of recalls since that federal agency began issuing warnings more than a half a century ago. That's why AAA Northeast urges consumers to visit nhtsa.gov/recalls or to download the Safer Car app to check the status of every vehicle they drive. Consumers can also sign up for periodic recall alerts through these sites. Once again, download the Safer Car app or visit nhtsa.gov/recalls to see if your vehicles are on the list.
All right. Well, you heard the preview on the award-winning For the People, and now we are here. We are at the Northeast Organic Farming Association Connecticut's conference at Wesleyan University. In person, Jeremy, before we talk about this great event today, how was your work of virtual workshops? Well attended?
They were. We had a great week, Monday through Friday, of virtual workshops. They were really well attended. And I think this is going to be a model that we're going to follow going forward in the next few years.
Do you find that you had the cross-pollination of people who took some virtuals during the week and said, I'm absolutely going to be there in the flesh on the final day?
Yeah, in fact, it was a little bit of a problem. When people registered, we asked them if they're going to come to the in-person conference, which is today. And, you know, folks had different answers, yes and no. A lot of the people that weren't originally going to come ended up showing up.
Uh-huh.
It's a good problem to have. We had to up the food count, but we found that people really enjoyed the virtual conference and wanted to be here in person.
So what are some of the reactions you're getting? Are you meeting some first-timers or some younger or more fledgling farmers or gardeners?
You know, this is just anecdotal, but this is the first year I'm seeing a very young and diverse crowd. Typically, our conferences have been, you know, older farmers, and we're seeing a very, very young group of people coming in this year. And again, it's anecdotal, but you look across at the faces, and it's a lot different than the makeup of what we had 5 years ago.
Any idea what you can attribute that to?
I think, you know, getting some younger, you know, getting new speakers in who are changing the way our food system should be, or they're changing the ideas of what our food system should be. Our keynote speaker, Leah Penniman, is a huge draw for the young folks with her work up at Soulfire Farm. So I think, dynamic speakers coming in and just a young crowd really trying to get into farming.
So let's flip over here a little bit. So NOFA was doing diversity and inclusion decades before.
Yes.
It was diversity and inclusion by a brand.
Mm-hmm.
But you guys have really been able to provide a voice for, black and brown agricultural professionals.
Yep.
And those who support them for years, if not decades. It's still a big, important part of the conference today.
It is. In meeting with our staff and planning this conference, I think it's a farm bill year. They're passing the farm bill in 2023. And I think it's a moment where CTNOFA can take time to listen to how our food system needs to change for historically ignored farmers in our food system, black farmers, brown farmers, Hispanic farmers, undocumented farmers, queer farmers, people who are not... Farmers who are ignored in our current food system and historically have been ignored. So I think it's it's a good moment to give a voice or to lend our voice to these folks.
And as far as the program today, what does this kind of put in your mind? Because we all know, if we're in event planning, that tomorrow's when you start thinking about next year's conference, pretty much. Anything that worked really well now that you've returned to this unique kind of partial online and partial in-person situation?
So we'll definitely have a hybrid conference next year. It will definitely do virtual and in-person. We'll stay at Wesleyan. It's a great venue. I think the challenge is registration, getting people to register early. A lot of people registered in the last 2 weeks, which I understand. I do it myself. Yeah. But I think getting registration out earlier, getting the keynote speaker announced earlier, just starting everything a little earlier is what our challenge is for next year.
Very good. And before we let you go, we didn't get into any spiel for NOFA, but can you just remind people how easy it is to enjoy the benefits of things like this conference and all the workshops and all of the, you know, the sort of familiar person-to-person support that is just going to help make our food better, our environment better, and the state of Connecticut better.
Yeah, you know, we'd love to have you join us. If you're not a member already, we have a lot of events throughout the year, oftentimes free, almost always a sliding scale if it's not free, so that everyone can afford to attend. You know, we work really hard to support our farmers, especially our organic farmers. And we have tons of programs from everyone from a home gardener to a landscaper to an advanced farmer. So I hope, you know, you'll find benefit in NOFA, and we'll hope you'll join us.
CTNOFA.org?
CTNOFA.org.
Jeremy Pelletier, Executive Director of CTNOFA, here from the floor of their final day, their grand finale of this week-long hybrid conference here at Wesleyan University. Jeremy, congratulations. Thank you, and we'll see you next year.
Thank you. See you next year.
All right. Well, we ran into Yasmin Urgulu with Reboot Echo. Reboot Eco. It's the joke around here at the conference today. Reboot Eco. And I'm told you're something of a mover and shaker in this reuse industry. Tell us about your company.
So Reboot Eco is a zero waste and refill shop. So thanks for calling me a mover and shaker. We do a lot of moving and shaking. But we have refill stations at our shops, so we're able to offer plastic-free alternatives and ways to not only switch over to non-toxic products and products free of toxins and additives and such and things that are locally made, but also packaged well. So you can bring your own container and refill these containers at our refill station. And then we also have all kinds of reusable products like paperless towels and things like that that demonstrate not only how we can shop locally and support locally and, again, use, you know, organic cottons or rescued materials, but also stop with the single-use plastic and otherwise.
So of all the careers in all the world, what's the backstory on this? What made you go down this avenue and become one of the first, if not the first in Connecticut, to sort of do this, right?
Yep, we were the first, and that was the problem, right? I couldn't find the solutions, and I discovered just how big the problems were, right? During COVID, some more time for reflection, some more time for watching documentaries, some more reading time. And I discovered that what I thought was a solution, you know, recycling, I thought I was recycling well. I found out I wasn't recycling well, and that not only that, recycling really isn't the answer, and that reducing waste and reusing and upcycling and repurposing, these are really a lot of avenues that we also need to go down. So I started to, you know, look at what I was doing, and I found that one of the big problem areas was household cleaners and bath products. I could see, I could change my food shopping a little bit and kind of start to avoid some waste, but with household cleaners and bath products, it got really difficult. So I then found that zero waste shops and refill shops exist in other countries, and a few existed, you know, a few years ago when I started this. A few existed around the country, but not really. The closest one was about 3 hours away.
Oh.
So I said, all right, well, Connecticut, I can't be the only person in Connecticut that wants something like this, that wants an alternative like this, that wants other options, right? So I built it, and they came.
Just the first person to cross the line into from what you want to what you can provide. So how does the business work? What are some of the things that you bring to the consuming public that helps the bigger cause of literally saving the planet?
So the biggest thing that I think that I provide and what our biggest focus is tackling eco-anxiety, right? So we have tons of products, and I can mention some of the popular ones that we offer. But really what it is folks are able to come into our stores or come up to our, you know, table when we are at an event and such, and they can see that there are solutions, that they have options, that they do have some control, that it's not hopeless, they're not helpless, that there are other, they can see then all these individual small businesses that we feature in our shop and on our tables. That are either in Connecticut or other parts of the U.S. that are making things differently, that are producing things differently, that are making a difference. And just seeing that makes folks feel like there is hope, there is a future, they do have control. Then they really feel like voting with their dollar is something that counts. And as soon as they feel that, as soon as that hopelessness goes away, then getting involved with legislation, their local, you know, their local government, et cetera, feels more attainable. It feels more like it makes a difference because they don't feel as hopeless. So that's our biggest thing. And it's some stuff is as simple as, you know, dish soap, laundry detergent, hand soap, all these kinds of staple products that we have, but also things like shampoo. We've got refillable shampoo. We have shampoo bars that are really, really good. We have deodorant that just works better than other natural deodorants, right? Happens to also be plastic free, happens to also be refillable, but it just works better, right? So we really focus a lot on, or we only focus on products that work just as well, if not better, in most cases better, than what folks are used to. So it's also changing the stigma of, that hippie natural stuff never works as well, you know? So it's tackling all of these things and just getting folks to kind of reboot their way of thinking, right? Yeah. And it's all about rebooting, so.
Well, on that subject, you confessed that you thought you were a great recycler, and then you found out you weren't. What are people doing that makes them think they're good recyclers when maybe they aren't?
Well, the biggest issue is the recycling symbol. The recycling symbol we're all familiar with doesn't actually mean anything, and it's not really there's no really, you can just put it on anything, right? Now, there's numbers inside those recycling symbols, if it's used correctly, that really mean whether it's recyclable or not in Connecticut, in our local recycling streams, et cetera. So understanding those numbers, there's a lot of numbers. I wouldn't be able to necessarily, you know, relay them all here, but not all of them are recyclable. Just because it has a recycling symbol doesn't mean it can be recycled.
Oh, okay.
And there's such a thing as wish cycling. And wish cycling, we refer to, you know, hoping, you know, I think this might be recyclable, so let me just toss it in here and hope that it gets there. There aren't magic elves that will just separate that down the line. That incorrect recycled item could potentially contaminate the entire batch, because then when folks, you know, it's costly to have these folks picking through everything. When they see a batch that has a bunch of unrecyclable items in it, that whole thing can go into the trash, which then goes in the landfill.
And also, I guess, creates more potential fossil fuel use or electricity,
exactly.
Human resource,
exactly.
Because it's already been through a full recycling process only to be tossed into a landfill.
Yep. So not only will it sit in that landfill, especially when it's a plastic product, not only will it sit in that landfill not breaking down, staying there forever, taking up precious, you know, space. I mean, now in Connecticut here, space in, you know, landfills is becoming more and more of a topic. But
you
also,
not burning as much anymore either.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Now, but also, like you said, virgin. Now, when it's not recyclable, that's now stuff that will need to be made from virgin materials, which then means fossil fuels, then means, you know, more
products.
Exactly.
Recycling.
So it really is. It's a big ripple effect that we want to avoid.
So how do people learn more about your organization and your movement, and how will they come to you?
So we're online and on social media, Reboot Eco. We're at rebooteco.com or at Reboot Eco on Facebook, Instagram, and newly TikTok too. Not very active. Don't look for a lot there. But so folks can find information about what we do online. They can follow us on social media and see about our events. We have a swap studio in our Middletown location as well. We do have two locations, one in Middletown and one in Chester. Our Middletown location is our flagship location, has a swap studio, which is basically a free shop open every Sunday. And you bring one item and leave with as much as you'd like.
Fantastic.
Household items, clothing, things like that. So all kinds of ways to just keep this stuff out of the landfill.
Yasmin Ergulu, who taught me how to say reboot eco the right way. Thank you, Yasmin.
Thank you very much for your time and your questions.
Well, it's not just about plants and vegetables here at the CT NOFA conference at Wesleyan. It's about sustainability too. And one of the things you may not think about when you think about sustainability is appliances and electronics and things like that. And I'm so pleased to run into Bill Agley. Mr. Fix This is his enterprise. And Bill, I have to say, I'm probably a sinner in your eyes because I had an air fryer that went a little crazy, and I couldn't get the mess scraped out of it, and so now it's just sitting on my front porch waiting for that moment where it can get thrown away. I know I'm a bad man in your eyes for that, but in all seriousness, tell us a little bit more about what you're doing here today at this NOFA conference.
No, you're absolutely not a bad man. You're just maybe a little uneducated of what we can do to things like that.
Great, great.
So we can definitely fix things like that. I've actually had the experience of fixing an Instant Pot. Took the thing apart, was able to fix it, put it back together, all good to go.
Okay.
A couple of years now. So what we're looking at doing is the repair part of the sustainability. 6 R's, 7 R's. Mm. They keep adding and getting added to.
Yeah, we're like a throwaway society here, and you're on a mission to make sure that we don't throw so much away.
That's exactly right. We have these repair cafes that people can bring things to. It's a free event. We try to hold them once a month, and people bring stuff out. We can fix it there, or we can take it back to the shop and fix it. But then we also go out to the homes. We like to call them home therapy visits, where we actually go out, go to the home, take a look at maybe an inspection report, and see things that are on that we can actually fix. An inspector can come in and just tell you what's wrong, what's broken, but he can't fix it. He can't touch it. That would drive me crazy. I have to fix it. So we get out there, we fix things in people's homes, and it, you know, a couple hours, we can do all sorts of things: electrical, plumbing, appliances, you name it.
You only need to run into a vintage home appliance at a thrift store, or maybe on a back shelf in a garage, or in your grandma's, under your grandma's sink or something, and you pick the thing up, and it's like there's substance to it. The toaster of my youth weighs 6 times what the toaster of today does, and there's a reason for that. It seems like they're always built better, so why not keep the oldest things alive as long as possible, right?
That is absolutely true. I've fixed so many clothes dryers in my time. It's just that they were built better 20, 25, 30 years ago. They were built, I don't want to say better, but to last longer. And when those parts start to go, we have replacement parts that can take care of that. A $30 kit can replace all the components that are bad on a dryer and get that thing running good as new. Vacuum it all out and you have a good unit.
What are a few of the things that are around people's houses sitting in the junk pile that are, in your eyes, the most sustainable, or, you know, what are the most frequently wasted or tossed but sustainable electronics or appliances?
I'm seeing a lot of the portable batteries, like for different like DeWalt and Milwaukee, those type of batteries that just get tossed. I don't know if you've seen the recyclable thing at Home Depot, but they just throw those away, buy new ones. I mean, that's a big expense. We can actually rebuild those. There are rechargeable batteries inside that, and we can get those replacement cells, and we can fix those, and you know, keep those out of the landfill. I think that's a big one right there. But I'm also seeing just so many appliances that are just getting, because there's something wrong with it. I fixed an $800 microwave that was a $5 fuse. Things like that. Mm-hmm. That the person was like, oh, I'm going to have to go get a new one. And I was like, no, we can fix that.
So how much do you need to know to be able to do it right and safely Is it a DIY skill one can safely and easily learn, or do they really need to involve a specialist like yourself?
It depends, honestly, what it is. The dryer, it's really methodical. You take it apart piece by piece. There are YouTube videos. Absolutely, there's YouTube videos for that. But finding a good one that you can find that you know you can follow and all that. I'm more than willing to look over somebody's shoulder for something like that as well, because I'm all about education and teaching those people, anybody, how to do it themselves so that I don't have to do it for you, teaching them to be independent, sustainable homeowners.
One of the other interesting things I see here on your table are one of these LED bulbs that are supposed to last forever. So I guess there's a way to make them last forever times two.
Honestly, what you're looking at is a test bulb that I made, and it's okay because it's a YouTube video actually that I saw that for bad LED bulbs, you're able to make a test unit out of that, and I can test other LEDs using that bulb. So we've repurposed that. How's that?
Yeah, that's fine.
So that's okay. Yes, when those go, they're pretty much shot because those little LEDs that are on there, you can't really do anything with that, unfortunately.
Well, speaking of repurposing, and before we let you go, I asked you about the most frequently sustained product, but when a product does hit the end of its life, what are a couple of creative ways you've found to repurpose stuff?
Like, a big thing is the corrugated plastic signs, the lawn signs, something simple like that. Yeah. You've seen those all around at election time. Well, we can actually reuse those for many different things. They're strong. The wire that's in that, those are very strong. Things like that, they're definitely able to be repurposed. And I'll tell you what, and I brought it today, a Chinese food container. The metal latch on that, I've used that for so many different things because it's a nice stainless steel piece, and it's something that I have a collection of them now, but they're things that you can use, you know, that you don't have to get thrown away.
Sure, and if you think of going to a big box store and buying a whole roll of it just because you need about 8 inches of it, you're definitely saving yourself $8 or $10, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Any other advice to folks before we say farewell?
Keep an eye on your things. You want to be a sustainable homeowner. And you just need to pay attention to your appliances and things when they're telling you to they need help. You give us a call.
Just say Mr. Fix This, right? Is that your
Fix This?
Is that your web handle too?
That is it. Mr. Fix This LLC. Mr. Fix This LLC. .com.
Bill Agley here at the NOFA Connecticut conference at Wesleyan University, talking sustainability and making it happen with his own two hands. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Well, we found a little bit more of a quiet corner here at the Northeast Organic Farming Association's Spring Conference here at Wesleyan University, and we have run across Judy Apicella, who has two enterprises here today that actually kind of complement each other. She's representing her Bella Alpacas and Home Harvested Herbals. So, Judy, thanks for joining us for a few minutes. Beyond that introduction, tell us a little bit more about the synergy between the alpacas and all these products that you're selling and showing here today.
Well, it's funny because a lot of people have been calling me a homesteader, and I didn't even understand that I was one. It's just the way I lived, and we rescued alpacas years ago because a lot of people were getting alpacas, and they thought they were going to make a ton of money, and they weren't. Alpacas are wonderful. They're beautiful, and you're not making tons of money. So they were giving them up, and we started collecting the ones that needed a home and made a sanctuary. And we started getting socks made and going to farmers markets and selling the socks. And on the farm, I don't grow a lot of herbs. I grow some, but a lot of herbs grow naturally. And I like to use those in my herbal practice to make different formulas. Some of them I devised in synergy with the alpacas. There was one alpaca who was raw. He had eczema, and so the vet gave up on him. So I didn't. I made a formula, and that's my eczema spray and eczema. Imagine solving down a whole alpaca, but I did it, and he got better. Wow. And then things that I make for people, gut formulas, and I'm a nutritionist, and I help people through my herbs, through the nutrition. And again, the homesteading, it just fits together so beautifully because everything grows on the farm. I make things that grow on the farm. I help heal animals. I help heal people. And then everything that we make, again, from the socks goes to the care of the alpacas.
What town is your farm in?
New Milford.
Oh, great. So tell us a little bit about the early days of starting. I mean, it must be quite daunting to even figure out how you want to get started. How did it all get started for you?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, so originally we lived in New York City, and we moved to the country, and we had a farm, and I had a friend. It started out with two pigs. I had a friend who said, oh, my pig had little babies. Why don't you take two pigs? And we're chasing them around. There I was one day, literally jumping after a pig face down in the mud, saying, this is what I pictured when I moved from New York City.
Kind of like the Green Acres scenario, right?
Exactly. And then one day I went to a sheep and wool festival with my dad, and my son was little at the time. He's 19 now. And I saw an alpaca, and I fell in love. And I said, oh, I want this alpaca, and it would be so beautiful. And that was the realm of, we're going to make a lot of money. We're selling alpacas at a lot of money. And my dad laughed. He said, oh, you won't get an alpaca. And then a couple months later, unexpectedly, he passed away. And he and I were very close. And I said, I know you're with me. I know you're going to give me a sign. And long story short, this woman came. She wanted to stay in one of the houses on our farm, and wound up she couldn't. But she said, I have two alpacas. So this would be a great home for them. And then it built, and we rescued more. And now we have 15 alpacas.
Were you already into nutrition and the herbal side of things when you were in New York?
I loved natural healing, and I was a healer, and I would do Reiki, and I knew a teeny bit about herbs, but it wasn't really until I got here. And when I got here, I got this beautiful book, The Medicine Wheel Garden, and it's by Barry Kavash, who is a Native American descendant of Pocahontas, and I just loved the book, and I loved her. And the more I talked, somebody said, you know, she lives in the next town from you. I said, what? So they give me her number. I call up Barry, and she's the sweetest lady. She comes over, and she spends the whole day with me and my son journaling and my husband and teaching us about the herbs. And I thought, oh, my goodness, whatever you charge, it's worth it. And she said, no, darling, that's, like, on me. And we got to be good friends. She became my mentor and taught me pretty much everything I know about herbs, or guided me how to learn about it through self-teaching.
So what are some of the most popular products that you're purveying and showing today?
So my most popular ones, besides the socks, I make this amazing gut formula, and it's really healing because it helps balance your gut microbiome, and it's helped a lot of people. The eczema spray is a really big one as well. And my pain salve. My pain salve is a castor oil base, and that it's amazing for pain. And I have one for Lyme disease. I got a grant from the state of Connecticut, and I did research through University of Bridgeport on my Lyme remedy, which has helped over 200 people in the study with chronic Lyme.
Oh, wow. That's great. So how do people learn more about you that are listening?
So you can go to homeharvestedherbals.com. or Home Harvested Herbals on my Instagram. You can go to BellaAlpacas.com or Bella Alpacas Farm for my Instagram.
Excellent. Great to meet you. Judy Apicella. Judy Apicella with Bella Alpacas and Home Harvested Herbals here at the NOFA Connecticut Conference at Wesleyan University. Great. Great to meet you, Judy. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.